Hi, boys and girls. Like you, Santa is listening to the Merry Little Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com. Oh, 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 oh.
Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell rock.
Merry Christmas and welcome to this, the 30th episode of the Merry Little Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com. This is our simple and free podcast for the masses made in partnership with our year-round Christmas radio stream at KringleRadio.com. We have another podcast, our hour-long original podcast, which is available exclusively for the premier members of the Merry Forums of MyMerryChristmas.com, and we hope you'll consider joining us there year-round, where we talk nothing but Christmas every day of the year. My name is Jeff Westover. I am the Pumpkin King, you could say, of the Merry Forums, and we've been doing this together online since 1991, and for those of you doing the math at home, that's 27 years, folks. It is the middle of August, 2018, and everyone, it seems, right on schedule, has got pumpkin on the brain.
It's that time of year, pumpkin spice is here, I can't wait to drink, I can't wait to drink, I go to Starbucks twice a day, to get a pumpkin spice latte, they may say it's cray, but I say it's okay, so get to brewing, like what that barista's doing. Like my life's improving now that I have my sweet frothy pumpkin spice. Oh, I love my pumpkin spice, 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 spice. So it goes down so nice, 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 nice. You can't even get it iced, 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 iced. Pumpkin spice, pumpkin spice.
For whatever reason, the modern bellwether of pumpkin season is tied to Starbucks as the world breathlessly awaits the annual debut of their pumpkin spice latte. Have no fear, kids. We have the press release here and can tell you that the wait will not be much longer. It comes to overpriced coffee corners everywhere on August 28th this year, officially. Of course, Starbucks is not the only company to cash in on the pumpkin craze. At this time of the year, we see pumpkin everything, it seems. There's pumpkin Pop-Tarts, pumpkin Cheerios, pumpkin hot chocolate, pumpkin bread, pumpkin candy canes, pumpkin ice cream, pumpkin jello, pumpkin truffles, pumpkin peanut butter, pumpkin cookies, pumpkin pastries, pumpkin tea, pumpkin beer, pumpkin almond milk, pumpkin eggnog, pumpkin protein bars, pumpkin shakes, pumpkin smoothies, pumpkin cupcakes, pumpkin pancakes, pumpkin cough syrup, no doubt, pumpkin Oreos, pumpkin Eggo waffles, and even pumpkin Pringles. We kid you not. You hear all that, you'd think that pumpkin is a new discovery. Well, of course, we know that it is not. In fact, with all the pumpkin mania that descends on North America and the world every fall season, we are indeed flooded with recipes, facts, and history, so-called, of pumpkin from all-knowing food sites and history channels over the next couple months of fall. It's an odd thing, because the modern take on the origins of all things traditionally associated with pumpkins and history in America is that what we learned in school as kids is all wrong. They tell us that Columbus didn't discover America, that Christmas and Thanksgiving didn't really exist, that Charlie Brown wasn't really there. Well, okay, I'm kidding about that. But they also tell us that pumpkin pies were not served at the first Thanksgiving. Well, we're here to straighten all that out if we can, and we can, you see. Because in my house, well, we're pumpkin snobs. This episode is actually a few years in the making. I started my exploration of all things pumpkin when my wife decided that she was making pumpkin pie all wrong. Now, to understand this, you need to understand my relationship with food. It's a good relationship, a healthy relationship, which we love each other, you see, food and I. And pumpkin pie has always been close to my heart. My mom made it as a kid, and I swore that when she made it, it was the best in the world. This was, when we first married 3 decades ago, something of an intimidating thing for my wife, until she discovered that my mom, for as much as she loved me, was really no cook. Mom ruined me on things like Brussels sprouts and beets and broccoli because she cooked the heck out of them, boiling them in water until they were everything but edible. My mom could make a mean pumpkin pie, however, and that was because she followed the recipe religiously, as it was printed on the can of Libby's pumpkin that she got from the grocery store. My wife feared my mom's pumpkin pie because I would wax rhapsodic about it. I did so because my mom did that one completely right. But what my good wife never knew was her skill as a cook was something that she was born with. She and I cannot share space in the kitchen because there is an order, a rhythm, a routine of habit, a ritual in cleanliness and rules of cross-contamination and a feel to the dough or whatever that happens in the kitchen that I simply cannot know. There is a reason for everything she does in there, and I'm a knave when it comes to that space. I am my mother's son. If I am to cook anything, I do all the cooking that is done outside, which requires open flames and heavy saucing. My wife does the delicate work inside with all the precision of a surgeon. The first pumpkin pie my wife ever made drove this point home to me in countless ways. It was simply a miracle. She took my mother's Libby's recipe to a whole new level, and I heard Angel sing for the first time she made her pumpkin pie with her signature flaky crust. And for years, we stood by that recipe and what she did with it, and all was well and good and happy. Well, it was well for me. My wife, though, was not satisfied, and she vowed to make an even better pie. She felt something was wrong. Well, I think she was right, because in the course of working on my family history and researching my Puritan ancestors, I came across some 500-year-old recipes, including one of pumpkin pie. And my wife was supremely interested in it. And for over 3 years, she worked on that ancient recipe, experimenting with different kinds of pumpkins. She learned that Libby's, that stuff in the can that so conveniently comes from the supermarket, comes from pumpkins that are grown in Indiana and Illinois, a land of high humidity and evidently a land of bitter water. And this leads to a less than perfect pumpkin. These days, Libby's is led by large corporations headquartered in distant high-rise offices thousands of miles away, and they work the strip mining of pumpkin and pack them into cans, which is now number one source for most pumpkin pies made in America. And I would tell you it's good. I would tell you those who do it right, like my wife does, it's a very good pie. But evidently this is all wrong. Pumpkin, much like fine wines, is only as good as the place they come from, and the best ones, I'm told, come from New England. There are different varieties, types, shapes, and colors of pumpkins, and only certain kinds can go into a true Puritan pumpkin pie. Gone now, in our kitchen at least, are signs of any canned pumpkin. It has to be fresh. Our annual ritual of pies happens only as my wife handles these delicate, kind of small sugar pie pumpkins, carving and slicing them up with only a stainless steel blade, boiling them slightly in only a copper kettle of sweet water, followed by a low temperature roasting in a convection oven. The pumpkin is then let to sit, to mellow, I believe is the term she uses, as it cools, and then it is mashed only by hand, and then strained only by hand, and only then does the now secret mixture start to come together, featuring the spices of nutmeg and ginger and cloves and cinnamon and, of course, sugar. Sugar is another source of delicate choice and secrecy. It comes in many forms, from pure white cane sugar to molasses to even sugar of a maple variety. Again, that's a New England staple. There comes a period of simmering, of stirring, with a wooden spoon only, and of a rising aroma that is at once romantic and enchanting. And if conditions are just right, and she swears to make the pie correct, it's got to be like this. This all happens on a rainy fall day, when the clouds gather and the cool breezes flow through the windows, where the scent of wet fall leaves mixes with the pumpkin and the spice, combined to create a kind of aromatic heaven. And somewhere in the distance, you can hear the chorus of angels warming up. My wife teases me because the fall is also a season of potlucks and gatherings, and she knows my incredible hesitation to ingest foods prepared by the hands of others, mere mortals, I would call them. They come well-intended, but place on the table pies with pre-made crusts, which is frankly a crime against humanity, as is any pie that sweats, and there's a lot of sweaty pumpkin pies at potlucks. My wife's pies have none of this, of course, and since she has found and adopted and perfected the Puritan pumpkin pie recipe that she swears comes from my ancestors of Simsbury, Connecticut, well, I could never, ever, in my wildest dreams, go back to Libby's. And to think we have one person to thank for all this, the singular, the great, and the maligned Christopher Columbus.
I claim this land in the name of Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand of Spain.
Ho!
Well, first I stick the flag in the sand, and then I...
Watch yourself, Admiral. Natives, they may be hostile.
Well, we're all a little hostile now and then. Some of us are able to sublimate, others can't adjust. You know how it is.
I know, but you better try and talk to them.
All right, all right. Hello there. Hello there. We white men, other side of ocean. My name, Christopher Columbus.
Oh, you over here on a Fulbright?
Huh? No, I'm over here on an Isabella, as a matter of fact. Which reminds me, I want to take a few of you guys back with me in the boat to prove I discovered you.
What do you mean, discover us? We discover you.
You discovered us?
Certainly. We discover you on beach here, is all how you look at it.
Yeah, I never thought of that. Well, at any rate, my men and I were wondering if you could spare a little food.
What kind num-nums you want?
Well, what is that strange-looking plant you're holding there, with little yellow kernels?
You mean this?
Yes. What is that?
French horns.
No. What you're holding in your hand.
Oh, corn.
That's what I thought it was. What else you got to eat around here?
Oh, berries, herbs, natural fruits, and organically grown vegetables.
That snippet of audio dates from the 1960s, and our friend Stan Freeberg, his History of the United States of America, is must-listen-to stuff, even if it is done in the name of comedy and music. It has held up very well through the years, but even in his mirthful view of the discovery of America, he buries hidden nuggets of truth, and one of the biggest we pay little attention to are the resources, not only in land and minerals and people that Columbus found in North America, but also in terms of food native to these shores. He quite literally changed the world, and he gets far too little credit for that. In fact, in another episode upcoming, we're going to talk about Columbus and how modern historians do him wrong, especially in terms of his faith and his contributions to Christmas. We say, put up his statues and give him back his day. But what Columbus unwittingly unleashed for us, at least for this episode of the Merry Little Podcast, was the obsession with pumpkin we find not only today in our time, but seemingly for all time in North America, and one that has always been a hallmark of the season between the months of August and January. Pumpkins, you see, are native to North America. Europe has since discovered them, and they've been found all over the world, but really, they come from here. And when Columbus opened the door to American exploration and settlement, he brought about an association with pumpkin celebrated now at Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. The pumpkin spice song played at the top of this episode is not original in its tongue-in-cheek love of pumpkin. People for a long time have placed their love of pumpkin in poetry, song, and composition, and they've done it for hundreds of years right here in the good old USA. For example, take this little poem from the October 17th edition of the American Beacon of Virginia, published in that newspaper in 1818. The bards of the Hudson may sing of the melon, its smooth jetty seeds and its ripe ruddy core, and the feast of the reaper with ecstasy dwell on, reclining at noon on the cool breezy shore. For me the rich soil of New England produces an offering more dear to the taste and the eye. The bright yellow pumpkin, how mellow its juices when tempered with ginger and baked into pie. Well, that poem waxes eloquent for several more stanzas, taking up about 8 inches of valuable newsprint space and wandering, of course, into the realms of love everlasting flavored by pumpkin forever. By the time such stuff was produced in the media, in 1818, pumpkin had long been established as not only a staple of the season, but one that required almost reverential respect. The media then and now liked to apply numbers to the season, and even back then they estimated the consumption of things like turkeys at Thanksgiving and Christmas. One of their less appreciated figures was the guesstimate in 1759 that more than 2 million turkeys would be consumed in the colonies, and better than 10 million pumpkin pies made over the course of the holiday season averaged a whopping total of 10 pumpkin pies per family per holiday meal back in 1759. The one thing to remember about the holidays of the 1600s, 1700s, and 1800s is not that they were different. They were. They were celebrated quite grandly because in the agrarian nature of those times, that was pretty much the only time of the year that families got together. The rest of the year represented far too much work that had to be done, or people just didn't survive the winter. But when the frost was on the pumpkin, as it were, and the harvest was over and stowed away, that was when the implements were put down and the family gathering began. And they were grand events. Thanksgiving, thus, was a gathering and a feast. Christmas was a gathering and a feast, most hallmarked by gifts for just the children and religious observances of the season for the adults. New Year's was a gathering and a feast as well, a more adult observance of good luck and prediction for the farming year ahead. These American seasonal routines were really holdovers from the ritualistic habits of their forefathers in Europe. But common to the American feasting season were certain elements. Absolutely turkey, duck, and goose were highlights of the meal, but it was pie, pumpkin pie, that was the star of the show in these fall feasts from north to south in America. One writer in 1630 said, "For pottage and puddings and custards and pies, our pumpkins and parsnips are common supplies. We have pumpkins at morning and pumpkins at noon. If it were not for pumpkins, we would be undone." All this is a pretty amazing fact when you consider that the plentiful pumpkin is pretty much a plain food. It is quite nearly tasteless. But that is an attribute that makes it so versatile. And how and why it was used in so many creative ways, both then and now. I grew up in the Central Valley of Northern California, called by some the bread basket of the world. I had no idea as a kid what a special place that is, and the fact that everything seemingly grows there without effort. As a kid, the local farms, thanks to the plentiful Delta waterways, grew incredible corn, anything better than you could get in Iowa or Kansas, and they grew huge and luscious berries and all manner of fruits, peaches, apricots, and plums and all their varieties. These were all possible thanks to mild humidity and hot, hot summer days followed by sea-driven cool nights and long growing seasons without frost. The farms of Northern California grow grapes like almost nowhere else in the world thanks to all of these elements, and the fall air in those parts is filled with the sweet, distinctive smells of crushed grapes and the making of wine, which makes Northern California another unique place. But one thing you never see in Northern California, and something new to me now living in rural Utah, is the root cellar. a dark, half-subterranean space dedicated to stowing produce in these places after a hard freeze sets in. You don't get those in Northern California because you hardly ever get a hard freeze, and there's no way that the soil could contain a cellar because the water content is so high. Where I live now is known as potato country, and one of the parts of fall at fruit stands nearly everywhere here in Utah. You can buy a 50-pound bag of potatoes, russets, Yukon golds, baby reds, for about $10 a bag, and families here still buy them in that quantity to store them in their ancient root cellars that they still have. Lots of other produce also goes there for long storage over the winter. Onions, squashes, and especially pumpkins. The long shelf life of pumpkins and the fact that one pumpkin seed can grow hundreds of other pumpkins in the course of a 70 to 90 day growing cycle in most places, the versatility in working with pumpkins and recipes because of its mild flavor was one reason that pumpkin was featured so prominently in holiday celebrations. As recipes from the time will show you, another reason is that pumpkin became the base to whatever delicacy they simply could not cook with at other times of the year due to the scarcity of those items, and I'm talking specifically things like sugar, nutmeg, cinnamon, and rum, which were limited and yet mixed so very well with the lowly pumpkin. Apples were another staple of the American diet, but they were never really part of holiday celebrations in America. And it's interesting to consider because apple pie, even today, is more popular overall than pumpkin. And that may be because it's available in both fresh and dried varieties almost year-round. But pumpkin is revered exactly because it is holiday fare. It's special. And nothing but the exceptional and the sweet, those things which made family gatherings such an annual highlight, would inevitably be made with pumpkin over the more popular apple. Thanksgiving Day was a regular occurrence in early American history. It wasn't always the fourth day of November. In fact, it could be held at any time of the year, and a year could feature several days of Thanksgiving because it was considered by leaders at the time as a general call to prayer. A time when Providence could be credited with something great happening that benefited everybody in the colony. But usually, it was a harvest event, and the season, Thanksgiving and Christmas, were tied together and often celebrated in much the same way. The post-harvest period was a season of gathering. Everything that could be done was done, and families now had a season at last to enjoy each other instead of their work. From the 1720s, some 100 years after the first serious settlements in North America were established, this verse was published in the press. Ah, on Thanksgiving Day, from east and from west, from the north and from south, come the pilgrim and guest. When the gray-haired New Englander sees his round his board, the old broken link of affection restored. When the care-wearied man sees his mother once more, and the worn matron smiles where the girl smiled before, what moistens the lip and brightens the eye? What calls back the past like the rich pumpkin pie? Another poet said, "Oh, the pumpkin pie is the freeman's pie, and in it we'll put our trust. No humbug like mince can in it lie, and it beareth no upper crust. If pumpkin pie but grew on trees and on the branches would sway, they would fill the air with a perfumed breeze, and I'd shake the trees every day." Well, this is all great. I can hear you saying, but what in the world does pumpkin love have to do with Christmas? Well, a lot more than you've ever considered. Pumpkin pie, thought just a staple of Thanksgiving these days, was, as we mentioned before, at every table in early America for Christmas and New Year's. It was a base for Christmas puddings and custards. It was served as well in making holiday ales, and of course, it was a regular ingredient in holiday wassails in America. That some no longer engage pumpkin as much at Christmas as was more popular back in the day is no reason to dismiss pumpkin as an element of Christmas. Perry Como's "There's No Place Like Home for the Holidays" sings the praises of pumpkin pie. So too does the song Sleigh Ride. Even the song Rocking Around the Christmas Tree features lyrics that speak of later we'll have some pumpkin pie and do some caroling. These songs all come from the mid-20th century and drew from the ancient traditions of the families of their writers. Pumpkin, you see, has a big place, as big a place, I would say, as mistletoe and candy canes and eggnog in our Christmas celebrations. It just happens to be an element these days that is featured first, the real Christmas creeper of the holiday season. One final note to bear in mind as you count down the days to Christmas, there is such a thing as National Pumpkin Pie Day, and that day, kids, falls every year on December 25th. I'm not making this up. Go Google it. And the reason it is, and has always been celebrated on December 25th, is because pumpkin pie has always been part of Christmas. Enjoy your season of pumpkin happening now, and join us at the Merry Forums of MyMerryChristmas.com, where we will serve up a piece for you anytime you ask us. And for all of us at the Merry Forums, this is Jeff Westover wishing you and yours a very Merry Christmas.